This is the Hollywood Casino Press Box. Now back to Frank Cusimano on 590 The Fan and 590thefan.com.
We are back. We are one of the most enjoyable and relaxing places in St. Louis. Big Island Spa, 1300 Washington Avenue. We are all donning the leis.
If Monique is listening, Frank has a lei.
Yes.
We're wearing these. We're festive. It's Big Island Spa, 1300 Washington Avenue. It's a good day to be indoors, and it might be a good day to schedule a massage.
Absolutely.
Because it's a dreary, brutal day. I don't know when we moved to Seattle, Frank, but this must be what it feels like.
A relaxed room they have with the music. They got the waterfall, and they have yoga classes. I could picture you in a yoga class doing the stances and stuff.
I might try it. I could see Frank in the massage, you know, just they're supposed to relax, and they're playing Yanni for him, and he's still on his phone texting work, setting up some interviews for later in the day.
Hey, we're delighted to have with us today a man who ran three different organizations, the Rams, the Cardinals, and the Eagles, the one and only power attorney here in St. Louis, Bob Wallace. Bob, great to be with you. How are you?
Thanks, Frank. Great to be with you guys.
Move that mic up just a little bit closer to your mouth.
And podcaster as well.
And podcaster, right.
Are you podcasting?
Podcaster, webcaster. Yeah, we do a podcast. I do a podcast called After the Buzzer.
Oh, nice.
And we've had some really interesting
people.
Have
you called the Charles Barkley card in yet?
Not yet. I was talking to Charles recently about after Auburn went in, you know, and he was – the only reason I was rooting for Auburn a little bit was because I thought he was kind of cute when
he was
when they did that.
And the Barkley connection, is it good time in Phoenix or Philly?
It's in Philly that I met him. And Charles is one of the nicest people that you'll ever meet. He is not, you know, a lot of superstars, and I put him in that superstar category, are kind of standoffish. But I met him once, and it's kind of a funny story. I met him. We were doing a panel together at Villanova Law School, talking about contracts and holdouts and all that. And then afterwards, Charles and I, he was just flirting with every girl in the school, and I was having a great time with him. He was just really funny, and I called my wife and said, "You're lucky I'm married. Otherwise, I'd still be hanging out with Charles Barkley."
Hey, quick update, by the way, on your son Grant, who was one of the great football players in John Burrow's history, had a great college career at Yale. He's now with the Dolphins.
He's the Midwest scout for the Dolphins. He actually has moved back to St. Louis, and now he scouts, you know, Michigan, Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, Kentucky, and some of those.
So he's pretty young to have that kind of title. What is he, like 26, 27?
He is 26, yes. He's 26, and, he's a smart kid. And he's quiet, so, you know, he's not obnoxious.
Whoa, and this is your son?
Right, he's much different.
He's quiet, he's not obnoxious. Wait, this is Bob's son.
He took after my wife, right. He's much nicer. He had a good draft. They took three guys from his area, so I guess that's a good draft where that means the pressure's on.
So he would file reports basically all fall going to football games.
Right.
You go to a Michigan or Ohio State game, and then you put in a report, and then they get close to the draft, and you kind of tweak what you have on each player.
Right.
And
yeah,
where the Dolphins, do they allow their scouts to actually be in the room, unlike the Raiders?
Yeah, unlike the Raiders, yes, they do allow their scouts to be in the room. So he just got back a couple days ago from the draft, and, you know, the Dolphins had an interesting draft. You know, they traded for the quarterback from the Cardinals, and I thought they had a really good draft. I was as a Dolphin fan, which
okay. Speaking of drafts, take us back to this. Bidwell would have scouts, or George Boone would have scouts, and then he would not listen to those scouts, and he would draft Steve Pisarkowitz.
No, he listened to his scouts. He wouldn't listen to the coaching staff.
Oh, the coaching staff.
The coaching staff. The Cardinals were very, very in those days scout centric. So the scouts had probably more influence than the coaches. I mean, Hanifin had to fight his way into the draft room. He finally did fight his way into the draft room, and then Stallings got to be in the draft. But they didn't have as much input. It was, George picked the team.
George Boone. When did that shift, do you think? I'm picturing Jimmy Johnson in Dallas calling all the shots, but that's late 80s, early 90s. because even a Chuck Knoll in Pittsburgh probably just took whatever they gave him, right? I mean, it, in the 70s, the early 80s, the coaches weren't really dictating who they drafted.
Well, you know, it depends. I mean, no, I actually think Chuck had a lot more input into who the Steelers drafted back in those days. You know, when I started back in, I started in 81 for the Cardinals, the NFL football was a lot smaller than it is now. I mean, you know, we had no marketing department for the Cardinals, and we didn't really have I didn't really see marketing departments until 1991 when I went to the Eagles. And the Eagles were one of the first teams to have a marketing department, so they were much different. And, you know, there were player personnel people, there were GMs. The GM was a much different position than it is now. They were, you know, the George Youngs of the world and Bobby Bethards. They were football-centric organizations. And then, you know, the NFL under Jerry, when Jerry Jones came into power and some of those guys and Norman Brayman in Philadelphia, they really made it more of a business. And so there was a lot more marketing, and the organizations grew.
What's your best ever draft story, either St. Louis Rams, St. Louis Football Cardinals, or Philadelphia Eagles related?
You know, I there are a lot of them. There are a lot of good stories about that. You know, everybody remembers the time when, and I used to actually not be in the draft rooms a lot of times. So I would just be somewhere where, and after we drafted a guy, I would call the agent and introduce myself to him, especially when I was with the Cardinals. And, you know, the story is when we drafted Kelly Stouffer, and Kevin Hargan says, "Jesus, they finally drafted a girl," and everybody laughed. You know, I mean, it wasn't a draft story, but, you know, we didn't sign Kelly Stouffer for a whole year. You know, he sat out
and
for
a year.
And
nobody noticed, Frank.
He sat out for a whole year. So that was, you know, that was an interesting time. You know, that time with Stouffer was interesting. When we drafted Lawrence Phillips, that was really interesting. I mean, we drafted Phillips, and we brought him into town. And we sat down and talked to him. I was in a room with him and a couple of our PR people, sort of trying to say, you know, you're going to be asked a lot of tough questions because of his background. And rest, you know, may he rest in peace. He's no longer with us. And so we talked to him about it, and I'll never forget after that meeting saying to Allison Hawk, who was worked with us, we both said, this is a rough guy. You know, he was a tough, rough guy. And, you know, you couldn't really soften him.
Yeah, didn't he botch at the press conference when he said, "What have you learned from your problems?" And he said, "I learned that you have to get a limo if you're going to get drunk at the club," or something along those lines.
He might have said that. I'm not sure he was that aware that he would have come up with that line, but it's a good one if he did come up with that, I guess.
Do you remember in 97, because Vermeil famous, when they finally said, "We got to cut ties," and Vermeil was crying, I think Randy Naughton said, "You seem upset, coach." It was the great prompting, because Vermeil said, "You're damn right I'm upset." But I'm wondering, before that, was there internal strife over what to do, and did Dick kind of jump on the table and say, I'm gonna fix this kid? Just, I wonder how many times you guys said, "We probably need to cut ties."
Well, you know, one, Dick was very emotional. I mean, you guys were around him enough that he would cry at the drop of a pin, you know, so he was a very emotional guy. And he also was a very caring kind of person in some respects. And, you know, he did believe that he wanted to help this young man get better. I mean, one, we had invested, you know, a high draft choice in him, and he did have talent. And Dick decided that he wanted to, you know, try to save him. But Lawrence was, you know, as I said, he was a tough, rough kid who had a really tough, rough upbringing. And he probably wasn't savable, and obviously he wasn't as his life progressed.
And Coach Vermeil believed, like every player. Well, I mean, Tony Banks wasn't a bad guy or anything like that, but he believed in his heart that Tony Banks could become a Pro Bowler. I mean, Jim Steiner tells the story that when you got Trent Green, that Dick was still hesitant of saying, "Hey, Trent's going to be our starter," because he still had Banks technically on the roster. Then they eventually had to move him.
Well, you know, that's the Dolphins are saying the same thing about Josh Rosen. You know, you got to compete. You know, everybody's got to compete for a position. And, you know, Dick, speaking of, I did a podcast with a GM from around the league, and we were talking about Dick's philosophy is, once you made the team, he didn't necessarily, you know, you were kind of on the team. You were one of his guys. He didn't really, and you know, part of the philosophy in the NFL is to churn the bottom of the roster so that, you know, you're always bringing, you know, the last five guys are always on the bubble. And Dick didn't believe in that, because he kind of believed that, you know, he wanted you to buy into his system and, you know, be part of his team. You never know when your time is going to come up. Look at Kurt Warner. Never know when your time is going to come up.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned Kurt, because this gets thrown around a lot right now with Jordan Binnington, who's leading the Blues, and we don't know how far it'll go. Probably shouldn't make the comparison until he gets a trophy in his hands. But he did seemingly come out of nowhere, yet he was with the team. They just sort of overlooked him. And Kurt Warner, if we go back, he was there in 97 and 98, and he was just kind of on the team and just kind of hanging around. A lot of people now, oh, I knew he was going to be great. But I always point out, he was exposed to the Cleveland Browns in the expansion draft in that building, and I'm sure now everybody says, I knew he was going to be great. When you found out Trent was out and we're going to Warner, the whole building had to be like, oh, my God, what happened to our team?
Right. You know, you're right. No one knew who Kurt Warner was. I used to joke afterwards because everybody was claiming that, you know, they knew Kurt was. I said, well, he's my son. Because, I mean, that was as ridiculous as we knew he was going to be a great player when we put him on the expansion draft. I'll never forget, speaking of my son, we were playing in a basketball game at, this was 1998. So, I mean, he was 10, 11 years old. And there's this guy on the end of the gym with his daughter who's playing basketball in you know, one of these little peewee leagues. And I'm looking, I said, I know that guy from somewhere. And so I said, hey, I didn't know who he was. I didn't know his name or anything. And it was Kurt Warner.
He's like, hi, Bob, I've seen you in the building.
Right, I've seen you in the building.
You signed my checks.
Right, hi, how you doing? Okay, great. A year later, Kurt Warner couldn't walk in to the Parkway Central basketball court without being mobbed. And, and nobody knew who he was. And when he got hurt, it was a preseason game against San Diego. And, you know, you remember, Marshall didn't pick up a blitz, and Rodney Harrison kind of took a shot that they now have outruled. I'll never forget Marshall kneeling, Isaac slamming his helmet on the floor. I mean, the team was kind of devastated. And I remember John Shaw and I were sitting up in the box, and we all said, we're jinxed. I said, we just got a black cloud over us. Because I think the day that Trent got hurt, he was like 13 for 13 in that first half against San Diego. I mean, we thought we finally had.
He was 28-32 in the preseason,
right,
too.
And in that game, he was just like red was on fire. And so, you remember Dick's famous press conference when he would say, we will rally around Kurt Warner. You know, he's crying, he's rallying around. And I remember saying to the people in the building, the business side, which was what I was responsible for, I said, don't walk around with your head around down. I said, you got to, everybody see a coach, smile at him, say, we'll be okay, give him some encouragement. And, so that was kind of what our role was. And obviously everybody knows the story.
I know ultimately with Stan Kroenke, it's always about the money. But let me just throw this scenario at you. Mike Martz actually has a good game plan, and you beat the Patriots and win that Super Bowl. And then Martz has this successful run where there's not chaos in the front office with he, Zygmunt, and Charlie Army. And it's a normal organization where roles are defined. Do you think the Rams are still here?
You know, I mean, you can ask that scenario about the Cardinals. If Neil O'Donoghue makes the field goal in 1984, do we get a new stadium? Is there some, momentum for that? That's hard to say, Frank. I mean, there was a lot of, that was a different group of people. I mean, they were all kind of peculiar in their own way. Jay and Mike got along great for a while, and then they didn't get along. And Charlie was kind of the man out. The way John set it up, which probably not a great way to set it up, was there were three people responsible for the football side, and they each had a vote, so it would not be, rarely you would have 1-1-1. If they did, John obviously would break it, but usually it was 2-1.
If allegiance is forming.
Right, so it was sort of like, it was like politics when they used to work, where people would make, compromises and make deals to, you support me here, I'll support you there. I'm not sure that's a great way to do it, but that kind of broke apart because Mike and Jay just over time, and if you look around the league right now, you're reading about the Jets and Adam Gase and Mike McCaw are fighting and San Francisco,
Shanahan
and I mean, why can't people get along? I mean, is the ego so great in these kind of positions that nobody wants to learn how to work together?
But if they win that Super Bowl, maybe the city is more inclined to revamp the dome. But I think if it's up to Stan, he's moving no matter what. I think most of us believe that now. He kind of had this L.A. dream for a long time. He'd lived out there for a long time. with the city, though, and you know the Dome people pretty well, do you think if there was a little more buzz and hoopla at that point, would they have ever been able to do enough to satisfy that lease? Because you could probably always argue, well, those renovations were great, but it's still not top tier, and Stan can still leave.
Right, right. I mean, I don't know whether that particular game had any effect on anything. I mean, the problem with what was, Stan wanted to move. I mean, he realized that, you know, he could move his franchise from St. Louis, which is the, you know, 22nd market in DMA, to Los Angeles, which is one or two. And the value of his franchise would increase quite a bit. So he understood that. And so it was hard to, you know, sort of renovate a dome. I always use the example that if I have a $200,000 home in Ladue and every other house is $2 million, if I put in another $200,000, I'm still not going to have a $2 million home. I'm going to have a $400,000 home. So that's, you know, every, you know, when this whole thing with the Rams began and the first tier thing, there was never an anticipation that there were going to be 22 new stadiums built around the NFL. Hmm. And so you'd have to assume that for them to be in the top tier, that out of 22, 15 of them were going to have to be stupid and build a worse stadium than the one that was built and was designed in 1986. And that just didn't happen. So, and part of it was the lease required that it be first tier within the term of the lease. So that it didn't. So, and Stan was unwilling to extend the lease. So you're gonna. So what the arbitrator said is, well, to make this a first tier, you have to spend $750 million, and $750 million to make it first tier, and he wasn't going to extend the lease. Really didn't make any sense for anybody. At least didn't make any sense for St. Louis.
All right. I don't know how much you can comment on this lawsuit. Is your law firm involved at all in the St. Louis lawsuit against the Rams and the NFL?
No.
Okay. So you can be our legal analyst here. Doesn't it appear to be trending St. Louis's way in terms of all of the rulings that, you know, it's not going to go to arbitration and it looks like it's going to go to court? Doesn't it seem to be trending that way? And you give me a ballpark figure of what the number could be if the Rams were to lose this.
Yeah, I can't give you a ballpark figure. I mean, I think there's, you know, anywhere from, you know, the $16 million that they, you know, they threw in to, you know, try to attract them to stay, and they spent on the Riverfront Stadium to $4 billion, which, you know, or $3 billion, the increase in value of the franchise. I mean, there's some people making that argument. I'm not sure that argument carries a lot of weight, but that is part of the argument that they have. And I agree with you. I think that the St. Louis entities have had a good run. I mean, not being in arbitration, I mean, you obviously would like to have a jury of your peers in St. Louis deciding a fate of somebody who's not very popular. So that's an advantage for St. Louis. But, you know, the NFL has a history of losing in the lower rounds and winning in the upper rounds. So, you know, and unlike St. Louis, which is a quasi-governmental entity, you're talking about one of the richest people in the country who has unlimited resources to spend on, you know, sort of, you know, papering you to death, which is part of a strategy in lawsuits.
But what has transpired so far? They've sort of been, and I think Frank was saying that it seems to have been trending in St. Louis's favor. The Rams have been scrambling, in a sense, what, to get it to arbitration? Is that because they don't want to be on the stand?
Yes. They, you know, an arbitration is a private proceeding, so they wouldn't have to have, open court testimony. If they want to put a good case on the Rams, I mean, obviously they're going to have to put on witnesses, which might include Stan or Kevin or somebody who St. Louis and people would do it. But it wouldn't be necessarily broadcast on Channel 5 and Channel 2 as, you know, look who's here, look what they said today.
That's what they want. They don't want the public disclosure.
Right. They don't want the public disclosure.
And so if you're an attorney working against Stan Kroenke on this case, what you're trying to prove is that he did not follow the NFL guidelines, and he had no intention of staying, and he didn't negotiate fairly. Is that what you're
saying? Yeah, I think that's the basic claim against the Rams. And then, and also there's, you know, they've sued all the owners too. So that's really where the pressure will come in when these owners decide they don't want to be here in St. Louis giving testimony, don't want to have their depositions taken, don't want to spend, you know, time going through documents and all that stuff. That's where there'll be some pressure. But also, so the claim against the league is that they didn't follow their rules and that they misled it, and there's a legal, you know, theory of detrimental reliance, is that they relied on the representations of people around the league saying, keep going, keep going, keep spending money, you're doing the right things. They spent $16 million, and really there was no intention of staying.
Do you think at some point, if the other owners say to Stan, just get this, get, make this go away, as much as we know that Stan doesn't want to pull out the checkbook, do you see any scenario where he would settle and just say, all right, we've crunched numbers, here's our offer? Do you see any chance of that happening?
Well, you know, they settled the PSL lawsuit. So, yeah, I mean, I guess there is a, you know, again, I think, you know, and they didn't settle the Reggie Bush lawsuit, and they lost a lot of money. I think that sort of made them think, you know, we don't really want to be in front of a jury here in St. Louis. So, yeah, I think there's a possibility that they're gonna settle. And, you know, again, you know, depend upon what St. Louis entities decide they want as a settlement amount. But, I mean, you could come up with probably $30 million pretty quick if Stan gave in 12 and every other owner gave in $500,000, which is really not even is a minimum level salary player for each team right now at $500,000.
30 like sounds low. If I'm a St. Louis lawyer handling this, for the taking on the NFL, I mean, you'd be happy that Stan wrote the check. To me, that sounds a little low. Like, if Stan offered that tomorrow, I might turn it down. If I'm representing St. Louis, am I a bad attorney?
You know, I mean, it depends on what you get your $16 million back, and then maybe, you know, maybe
14.
Get 30.
Yeah. Where does that money go? Where would the $30 million go? Just to the
It'll probably go to the progress. RSA, the Regional Sports. They're the ones who had the money that they used to make.
Yeah. All right. How about this? Gut feel, percentage chances of Stan Kroenke being on the stand. If you had to guess right now that he'll actually be on a stand.
Less than 50.
Okay. How about Kevin Demoff?
More than 50.
And if I gave you a pay-per-view opportunity, it's not being shown anywhere in America, but Bob Wallace sitting at Thompson Coburn can watch Kevin Demoff on the stand, but my pay-per-view that I'm offering is $100. Would you pay it?
No.
Frank, would you?
Oh, I would.
I think I would.
I would.
Would you like to see him sweat a little?
I have no interest in listening to Kevin Demoff say anything.
Well, that's fair. Oh, right. That's a whole different point, yes.
Right. I have no interest in
we've
that.
Heard, we've heard that man live before.
Right.
But
no interest whatsoever.
That's interesting. Right. Yeah. Well, maybe the money would go to charity, Frank, right? Yeah. That's what we would come up
he
with.
He did try to educate St. Louis fans how to cheer during
like
games.
When,
right?
When there's a sack, you yell sack. And when to make noise, when not to make noise. It's funny because he didn't seem to know a lot about football from what I could tell. But.
Right. And it's not like we didn't have great fans here back in 1999 to 2004. I mean, it's, you know, I always said one of St. Louis's biggest problems was that we badmouthed, and I take part of the blame, is that we sort of denigrated ourselves so much that we actually began to believe some of that. We actually believed that this was the worst stadium in the league. It wasn't. We actually believed that this is only a baseball town. It's not. You know, look what the Blues are doing now. There's excitement about that. And I used to always say when we were good, even when we weren't good, when we moved here, there was a lot of excitement about NFL football. And you know, NFL, as Jim Thomas says, NFL football is it's America. This may be a baseball town, but it's America's. I mean, football is America's sport.
Do you have a USFL thought? I'm not XFL thought. Do you have an XFL thought in St. Louis? Do you think it'll work?
You know, I think they'll be challenged. I think the AAFF that went out of business, you know, I think they concentrated a lot on football. And I think their product was pretty good. I think their football product was really good. I'm not sure they concentrated enough on getting the business side so that they could sustain any success. They might have launched it too quick, so hopefully the XFL will do that. But, you know, the AFF sort of makes you think, do we have spring football? Is spring football what people want? Is there not enough? I mean, between the Super Bowl ending in February and then the combine and then the draft – basketball playoffs, the NCAA, you know, you have college football. I mean, spring football. I mean, there's enough football. Do you not need that break? So the question is, you know, the AFF, you know, and no spring football league has really been that successful. So the question is there an appetite for spring football? And is that a market that needs, or do we kind of like our sports calendar the way it is? I mean, you guys do this, you know.
I'll take it five Sundays a year.
Yeah, I do think it's nothing against Jonathan Hayes, who's probably a great guy and maybe a great coach. I think because the players are going to be slightly anonymous or not players you've heard of, I do think if I were running it, I'm not Oliver Luck, I would have hired somebody. Granted, Frank and I are guilty. We're always naming old-time players for every position, but I think I would have looked into Isaac Bruce, maybe being the offensive coordinator, maybe Mike Martz coming back. I just think that – I think the coach name matters with this league.
My name was then, and I've talked to people in the league because we negotiated with them to move into the Dome to play there. Is the name I always threw out was Ricky Prohl.
Yeah.
I mean, I think Isaac would have been great and a great name, but Ricky has coaching experience, so I always thought Ricky would be a you know 10
Isaac
years
could
of,
be his offensive coordinator.
Right, 10 years in the league as a wide receiver coach, is pretty good experience. You know, and Jonathan Hayes I think is a good coach. He has a good reputation. I may agree with you, Martin. That is there any? I mean, again, people are going to come because they want to support St. Louis's sports team. And you give them more to root for than not when you have somebody that they're familiar with.
Bob, great to see you. We really appreciate your time. Thank you, sir.
Where do they find the podcast? And you just keep every week what you say is one of these weeks it'll be me and Charles Barkley. Just keep saying that every week.
One of these weeks it'll be me and Charles Barkley. I think what is that thing called? Splinter. You can go to Apple and go to podcast. You can go to Thompson Coburn website, tc.com, and look at it. After
the buzzer.
Very nice. All right, the Stanley Cup is here. Howie Borough is here. We'll take a short time out. We're broadcasting live from one of the most serene, cool places in town, Big Island Spa, 1300 Washington Avenue. We will be giving away a gift certificate for Bob's reaching out for that gift certificate. Keep your hands away.
It'd be an ethics violation for you at Thompson Coburn.
No,
sure. Oh, what? Okay.
We'll be right back.